many, many topics in the Bhagavad Gita. In the past, I've even given courses just in the Bhagavad Gita. There's so much in it, but we'll discuss some of the topics. In Chapter 6, there's an interesting explanation of yoga. And you find this statement, for example, yata dipo nivata sto nengate supamaspritha, that just as a lamp in a windless place, or the flame of a candle or lamp doesn't flicker. So the yogi, that's able to control the mind, the consciousness is like that. If you think about it, things happen in life that depress us or exhilarate us or frustrate us or excite us, or all kinds of things are happening and we go up and down. And so the idea in yoga is that the yogi's consciousness is so fixed on something higher that it's like a flame in a windless place. It doesn't flicker at all. So that's an example which is given. Then there's a further statement that that in spiritual life there's actually a higher pleasure. And so there's a paragraph in the Bhagavad Gita in Chapter 6 where Krishna says that by the practice of yoga, when one is able to transcend lower consciousness, one becomes satisfied by, to use Krishna's language, atmanatmanam pashyan atmani tushati. It's a typical statement from the Gita that one sees the self within the self by the self. So this is a typical Gita statement that you see the self within the self by the self. And so in trying to understand what that means, of course, the first point is that our real self, according to the Gita, is not the body. The body was compared to a covering. The real self is... Anyone that's late has to stay and clean the room after the class. So that we have to make an endeavor, we have to actually exert ourselves, to use a favorite word of Jane Austen, that we actually have to exert ourselves and we have to see our real self within the self. At the present time, we're taking ourselves to be the body, basically. In other words, American or Chinese or African, this, that, whatever. Our body of particular race, particular gender, size, age, propensity, and so on. And so the idea is that one has to find the eternal self within all this, because the self based on the body, for example, in this life, this time around, if I got an American male body that's a certain age, then that's temporary. I mean, ultimately, this body will end. And according to the Gita, based on my consciousness and activities in this life, I have to accept another body. And so that identity, that whole identity of being male, American, and so on, coming from a certain family, all that will vanish, and I'll take on a new identity. The point here is that none of these identities, none of these temporary identities, are really me. So the purpose of yoga is I have to find who I really am, permanently, eternally, and not be faked out by the apparent identity which is based on my material body, and even to some extent based on the material mind. Because our minds also have different natures. Some people, for example, are impatient. Some people are patient. People have different personalities, different mental states. And according to the yoga system, to some extent, that too is temporary. Because, I mean, you can see some people, for example, when they're young, they're a certain way. As they get older, they develop a different personality. They calm down, or they get excited, or they change their interests. I mean, it happens all the time, unfortunately, in marriage or in relationships. People think they've got a great relationship, and then, lo and behold, the other person suddenly has some kind of like psychological extreme makeover. Or the person suddenly doesn't like what they liked, or doesn't like what they used to like, or likes what they didn't like, or just changes. People change. And so many a relationship, most of them, I think, I mean, that's what happens. Sometimes people change. So even our mental state, even that that aspect of us may just be a material covering that changes. So the idea is to find our real identity, our real form, In fact, there's even a term which is used a lot in this literature, and someone attacked the charge here. There's a word which is commonly used, swarupa, which means one's own form, your real form, who you really are, how you really look when you find your eternal identity. And so that's basically what yoga is. That's what the Gita is teaching. It is the great quest for the self, trying to find yourself. As inscribed, or as, you know, declared by the oracle at Delphi, know thyself. So anyway, so Krishna says that seeing yourself, when you see your real self, then sukham atyantikam jata buddhi grahamatindriyam veti, then you will realize a pleasure, a happiness, which goes beyond anything you've ever experienced before. That's the claim. And an interesting term, this pleasure, the spiritual happiness, is buddhi grahyam, which literally means acceptable to your highest intelligence. Like sometimes some things feel good, but then, you know, when you wake up the next morning, you wonder if you should have done it. And so the idea here is that this spiritual pleasure, your best, clearest, highest intelligence approves of it. Because you can see that it's in your ultimate self-interest. It satisfies not only the nerve endings in your skin, but it also satisfies your brain. It satisfies your highest sense of virtue, of the kind of person you want to be. It has integrity, and it's in every sense in your highest self-interest. So that deep satisfaction, Krishna says, it's a pleasure that goes beyond everything else, acceptable to intelligence, beyond the senses. And there's another point made in the Gita, is that real happiness does not depend upon bringing your senses into contact with a particular object. Like, let's say, for example, you find a certain scene beautiful. So as long as you can maintain contact between your eyes and that object, you're happiness. Okay, English. You're happy. However, if you lose that contact, between your eyes and that object, then you're unhappy. Or as long as we can eat certain kinds of food, and on and on and on, as long as we can hear certain kinds of sounds or be with certain people. So the idea here I'm thinking of an example. It's like those backlit screens. I mean, they used to have movie projectors. This is something you can read about in your history classes. They used to have these movie projectors where they would actually project light onto a screen. So if anything got between the screen, the screen was here. If anything got between the screen and the projector, then, you know, like you could do funny shadows on the screen or something, or if someone just, you know, stood up in the movie theater, and then you suddenly see this body walking across the movie, and everybody would scream, like, get out of the way, and so... But if the... This is actually a good example, I like this one. But if the image is being projected from within the screen, in other words, if it's self-contained, then no one can interfere with the projection of that image. So that's the idea. If your pleasure is coming from within yourself, there's no one on earth that can interfere with your happiness. You have absolute autonomy, absolute freedom to be happy and to be satisfied in life. However, if my pleasure depends upon a certain dependence, like, if this person likes me, then I'm the happiest guy in the world, and if that person doesn't like me, then I better increase the dose of my medication. So, it's that kind of dependence that Krishna's trying to get us away from. Real freedom means that I have the power to be perfectly happy, perfectly satisfied, and enlightened within myself. So, and ultimately, Krishna argues that all contacts, what's that word he uses? Samsparshaja bhoga. All pleasures which are based on contact, bringing, literally, in Sanskrit they call it a touch. The word sparsha means touch. In other words, as we would say in English, to bring something in touch with something else. So every pleasure which depends on bringing your senses into touch with some material object is temporary. And sooner or later, the contact will be broken, and you go back to go and don't collect $200 and so on. So Krishna says about the spiritual happiness, yanglam dvacha apanam labham manyate nadikang tatah, that that upon achieving this, upon achieving this spiritual pleasure, a person is convinced that there is nothing beyond this. A person is convinced there is no greater happiness than this. And just minstito na dukena guru napi vichalite. And the person cannot be disturbed or moved from their position in consciousness by any misery, no matter how heavy. Krishna says, guru napi, even by the heaviest misfortune, the person will not be moved from their position of clear consciousness and real happiness. And then Krishna says, tang vidya dukha sang yoga viyogam yoga sanghita. That's a play on words, the word yoga. Anyway, that's the definition of yoga. That's what yoga is about. Because the word yoga means link. So Krishna says that when you de-link, so to speak, to use like literal from the Sanskrit, when you de-link your material link, that's the real link. That's actually yoga. So now that I've preserved that play on words. So, then later in this chapter, Arjuna asks a question. Arjuna says, well, what happens if I begin this spiritual discipline? What happens if I sort of give up my material life for now, and then I take up spiritual practice, and I fail? What if I don't actually succeed? It's like if you go to college and don't actually get the degree, what happens to you? Or if you're taking the medicine and it doesn't quite work, like what happens to you? So what happens if I take up a spiritual discipline, but then I don't make it? Then what happens to me? I gave up my material life, so that's kind of ruined, and then my spiritual life didn't work out, so I'm nowhere. I'm worse off than if I'd done nothing. It's a very interesting doubt. And the word Arjuna uses for someone who's failed in their spiritual practice is ayati, which means literally one who lost control. One who, you know, they were trying to control themselves, attain this higher consciousness, and at a certain point just lost control. So Arjuna asked this question. And apraprya yoga sangsiddhi, not achieving the final perfection of yoga, kangatin Krishna gachati. Krishna, where does that person go? What happens to them? And then Arjuna says, isn't that person ruined in both? Literally, Arjuna says, ruined in both, material life and spiritual life. So, then Arjuna said, this is my doubt, Krishna. The etan me sang, it's very modern, I mean, in Sanskrit it sort of sounds like English, you know, Sanskrit. Etan me sangshayam, Krishna. Krishna, this is my doubt. This is my doubt. Chaitanya Maharaj says, so please, in English you remove a doubt or dispel a doubt. In Sanskrit you cut a doubt. That's just the way they talk. So you cut a doubt in Sanskrit. So Arjuna says to Krishna, no one but you can remove this doubt. So, then what does Krishna say? Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Krishna says, someone who sincerely took up spiritual practice is never ruined, will never be lost. And it was explained earlier in chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita, in the verse Nehavikam Anashosti, that Krishna teaches that whatever one is able to achieve in spiritual life, it's like it goes permanently into your spiritual bank account, and even if you don't make it all the way, you still have that in your account. It's still there. You still have that credit. And it's not like investing in American real estate. So, then Krishna says that no one, nahi kalyana krit kasya durga ding tata kasya, no one who does good is ever goes to a bad end. Anyone that really does good. In other words, sincerity pays off. Goodness pays off. And of course, you could think, what about the story of Job in the Old Testament? If goodness is always rewarded, why does it appear that nice guys finish last, as the saying goes? And it seems like, you know, the nastiest, most aggressive, brutal people somehow get power. And of course, within the system of karma, Krishna's talking about a system that plays out over many lifetimes. And here Arjuna's question is specifically about someone attempting to practice spiritual life, and Krishna says they'll always eventually make it, basically. If someone simply is sincere and tries their best, they'll eventually make it. And then Krishna says, what happens to people? What happens to people that didn't make it in this life spiritually? So first of all, he says, prapya punya kritanglo, ganu shitva shasati sama, achieving the worlds of the pious, the worlds of the virtuous. There are certain worlds in the universe where the pleasures are magnificent, And those worlds are reserved for those who thoroughly cultivated virtue. And so Krishna says, having achieved those worlds and having enjoyed there for a very long time, Ushitva Shashwati Sama, having dwelled there, enjoyed those worlds for a very long time, then Suchinang Srimatangi, hey Yoga Prashto Vijayate, the fallen yogi then comes back to this world, but takes birth in a home of sort of an extraordinary family. Either a family that has money, so that one has leisure time, one has the opportunity, the privilege of study and spiritual practice, because you don't have to just go out and, you know, and work hard from morning till night. Or the family of people who are very pious, who are very, literally, shuchi, which means in Sanskrit, sort of clean, decent, very decent, good people. And then Krishna says, the idea is that, or another alternative is, one directly takes birth in the home of spiritual practitioners, and that's considered to be even higher. Because if you take birth in a family of spiritual practitioners, you automatically get a big boost. So instead of only learning about Mickey Mouse and stuff like that, or whatever people learn about now as children, you actually get some spiritual topics deeply imprinted in your young psyche. And then Krishna says that a person who's taken such a good birth, they actually come back in touch with the consciousness they were in. In other words, if in your past life you achieved a certain level of consciousness, then in this life you just sort of bounce back to that same level. And therefore you find that some people are, the way Krishna puts it, jigyasu or abhijogasya, are interested in spiritual topics. They're just spontaneously interested. And some people are spontaneously bored to death by anything which smacks of spirituality. And so the fact that people have very different reactions, as Krishna would say, it's because of your previous practice. So if you achieved a certain level of spiritual insight in your next life, you're just drawn back to it. Actually, beyond, almost beyond your control. You're simply drawn right back into it, and you reconnect with your, if not all the, you know, the details of your past life, which would, I mean, imagine, sometimes that's brought up, like what if we remembered our past lives? And imagine the psychological issues you'd have, identity issues, gender issues, and, you know, family issues. I mean, basically, life would be psychologically totally dysfunctional. I mean, you couldn't function. If it were the case that you had many past lives, remembered all of them, you'd have real problems. So, but the idea that Krishna is explaining here is that you get back in touch with a certain level of consciousness. You see the world a certain way. You see people a certain way. You have a certain sense of what's right and wrong. You have a certain sense of what your rational self-interest is, what's really good for you, and what you should pursue. And all that just comes back. All that just comes back to this. That's what the Gita is saying. So, then Krishna says, Purvabhyasenati naiva, the person is drawn by their previous practice, literally, they want to understand spiritual life, and endeavoring seriously, they actually achieve perfection. They eventually achieve perfection. If not in one life, then in a series of lives. And Krishna concludes this chapter by saying that a yogi, and by yogi here we don't just mean someone who has an extremely elastic body, because we'll talk more about yoga when we speak about the Yoga Sutras. Basically, the classical yoga system is Ashtanga Yoga, Eightfold Yoga. The first two stages of this Eightfold Yoga are actually moral and disciplinary, in the sense that you have to give up, you know, all the things we really like to do, like stealing and being dirty all the time. Anyway, there's this whole list of things you've got to do. Be nonviolent and practice virtue. And then after that, yama niyama asana. Then you practice the asanas, the actual sitting postures. And the reason is because in order to meditate for a long time, you know, you can't get antsy. You know, you get cramps all the time, you can't meditate for very long. So the asanas, the postures, were just to give you the ability to be healthy and just sit for long periods of time and meditate. And then asana, then pranayama, control your breathing as an aid to meditation, and then you start to get into the real consciousness things, like pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi, and so on. We'll talk about that more later. But in any case, when ultimately the word yoga, maybe I should mention it now, because we're talking about it here. It comes from the Sanskrit word yuj, Sanskrit root, which means to link. And it's actually cognate with, you know, con, which in Spanish or Latin means with.